Despite all the problems we have with injustice and inequality in this country, very large numbers of Americans don't actively want to discriminate. Unfortunately, there are neurobiological forces at work, ways we're wired to take cognitive shortcuts that can prime us to harbor racist views below the surface of our own consciousness so that they may be invisible to us while causing us to act in ways that are harmful to other people, which is to say, we can't just intellectualize our way past racism. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There is some good news here. My guest says as brain research in recent decades has helped scientists understand the ways our less than perfect brains can lead us astray, that learning has also suggested ways we can address the faulty thinking that sometimes causes us to divide the world into us versus them along racial lines. Shakil Chaudhry is an educator and consultant who does justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion work. His book is called Deep Diversity, A Compassionate Scientific Approach to Achieving Racial Justice. Shakil, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
You write about the early years of your life as an anti-racism activist, in which, given your training and your life experiences, you perceived deliberate discrimination and oppression quite literally everywhere you looked. This is not to say those things don't exist and didn't exist, but it was a major factor in your burning out, right?
That's absolutely correct, Chris. When I was in my 20s, and I was really involved in this work, there's a crushing sense of how big the world's problems are. And frequently activists can feel like if they're not the ones doing it, the project's gonna flounder. And there's a way in which that process can make it so that we're constantly vigilant. We're vigilant looking for opportunities to disrupt, because that's what we've been taught. That's what we've been taught by our training, formal or informal, by our peers, by the academics that we've learned from. And as a result, we develop what's known as sort of like a protest orientation. It's like everything needs to be protested to a point where it becomes a habit and we can't stop it. And so, yes, there were many things that contributed to my burnout by my early 30s, which is about half a dozen years into my community organizing and racial justice work at that time. But how I did the work was also a big part of it.
So what changed when you started to investigate the unconscious mechanisms that are at work in systemic racism?
Well, lots changed. First of all, it made me suddenly aware that the lens that I had always used was a historical and sociological lens on how to do racial justice work. And that lens is really important. And that is the traditional lens on racial justice and social justice work. It's historical, it's sociological. What that does, though, is that it creates this faulty sense of everything is linear. So as a result, everyone thinks that when we look back at history, history's clear. History's clear because it's presented in a linear fashion. So as a result, people think that they would have been marching with Dr. King, that they would have been resisting the Nazis and hiding Jewish people in their basement, that they would have been, you know, supporting Harriet Tubman, free enslaved people. And the vast majority of us would be absolutely wrong, because change comes from the margins. There's only a small group of people that are at the front end of that change, and the rest of us are dragged along. And so what started getting me to realize was that I was very linear in my thinking. And when I started stepping out of my field and looking in other fields and started realizing the incredible role of emotions and how much emotions play out in our work, and that emotions are more impactful than our thoughts. In fact, neuroscientists would say that we feel rather than think our way through the world.
So what role do those emotions play in setting up that us versus them dynamic that's at the heart of so much racial injustice?
Emotions play a significant role, probably the most dominant role. So we know from research, for example, that our empathy circuits go off in our brain when we're literally just observing people of the same race as ourselves. And this is at the unconscious level, not at the conscious level. and that our in-group bias is such that that we tend to be more drawn to people most like ourselves, to people who look, sound, dress, talk like us, and that we tend to be more critical of people who are different, who we perceive to be different than us, racial others. And we see this across society in the over-policing of marginalized communities and the underservicing of the same communities, right through to the workplace, where we know that racial minorities tend to face the highest rates of harassment and discrimination, as well as the lowest rates of promotion and advancement. And a big part of this is how we are wired, that we come pre-equipped to want to marginalize people that are different than us, and to be more accepting, kind, and considerate to people most like us. That's called in-group bias. And that's one part of the equation, because the other part of the equation is that there's the biology at play. That's the hard wiring we come with. But the sociology, how we are socialized, is the nurture side of the equation. So there's nurture, there's nature forces, and there's nurture forces. We can't change the nature forces, such as our hard wiring towards people most like us, but we can certainly change the nature forces, meaning how we're socialized. And that has really been the journey of all the work we've been doing in civil rights era work, whether it's the time of Dr. King, whether it's predates that in the anti-slavery movements, or today when we're talking about systemic racism and how to challenge it.
So in your first chapter, you write about, frankly, a devastating experiment in which a number of subjects were exposed to an unmistakable case of racism happening to someone else in the same room. Tell us about that study.
Sure. This is a study that was done, originally done in 2009, 2010, and it was done a collaboration between York University and Yale University and University of British Columbia. And in this particular scenario, we basically had three students in a waiting room. And one of them is in fact an innocent researcher. The other two are in fact actors. And what the third student doesn't know is that they're kind of being watched, because as they're waiting for this research to begin, it actually already starts in the waiting room, where there's a black student and a white student. And the black student walks out of the room, and there's a slight bump against the white student's leg. And when the black student exits the room, the white student makes a really horrific racial slur that only gets used against black people. And the whole research is what will happen? What will the people do when they actually observe that situation? Now, what's interesting is that they had three groups of people participating. Some were actually witnessing, were actually in the scenario. Some were reading it, and some were watching it on video. And the researchers and the watchers were all activated. They were upset, and they could not believe this happened, and they were just enraged emotionally. And when asked, you know, later on in the experiment, who would they choose as a partner, 70% of the students chose the black student as the partner over the white student who made the racist comment. Now, what's interesting is that's what the readers did, and that's what the watchers did. But what did the experiencers do, the ones who were actually in the experience? Well, nobody said or did anything.
Wow.
And not only did nobody say or do anything, and this is in a university context, right? That when asked kind of about their emotional state afterwards, how they're feeling, no one even really commented that they were upset in any kind of way. And the kicker in this whole thing was that the majority of students, when asked afterwards who they wanted as their partner, of the ones in the experiencer group, the vast majority chose the white student as their partner over the black student.
So what does that tell you, Shaquille?
Well, first of all, this is well established in research, is that what we feel in the moment is different than what we think we will feel in the actual moment. See, we are terrible at forecasting how we're going to feel. We think we know, but we actually don't. In the moment, it's much more confusing. Again, this is like that hindsight bias. We project forward things we think we're going to do. When we get there, we often do the exact opposite, because in the moment, we're actually not tracking that. But when we look at something and we read about it or observe it, we know how we would act. But in fact, again, most of us are wrong.
As we've said, most of us also harbor biases that we're not aware of, which are called implicit associations. You're really mm-hmm. candid here. Will you talk about what you learned about your own biases when you took this implicit association test, which, by the way, is available online if anyone's curious?
Mm-hmm. So this was developed at Harvard, and part of the story I just told you is an exact example of around names and how white-sounding names have are generally given a preference in Canada and the U.S. Over non-white-sounding names, whether they are African-American-sounding names, Chinese, Pakistani, or Indian-sounding names. And so we see these patterns. When you do this test, it doesn't measure what you consciously say about yourself. It measures how you feel and what's at the unconscious level. And so it's a great starting point to have a conversation with yourself first and foremost to see what happened there. And I've discovered that at different times when I've taken the test over the years, I tend to have a pro-white bias and an anti-black bias at a low level. And sometimes I'm neutral and sometimes I haven't been. But there's a way in which that bias plays out, because it's part of my story. Because one of the things I talk about in my book is that I grew up in small rural communities, and often being one of the few people of color in that context. And in that context, what would happen is that, I mean, I was a popular kid. I didn't actually experience a lot of overt racism, but I didn't know how I was feeling. And what I realized that much later was that I actually, even though I felt very comfortable in my environment, there were certain things that I did that I couldn't name or touch until I was well in my 20s. So when I was in high school, for example, I never wanted to be around other brown kids. I never wanted to bring my mom's cooking, Pakistani North Indian cuisine, in my lunch. I mean, I loved it at home, but I never wanted to bring it up. There were these feelings of embarrassment and shame and self-hate that I didn't even know was going on. This is what I mean about the feeling level, is that what we can't see has more power. But when we can identify something, when we can name it, we can also tame it. And so this is why we got to start connecting how we think with how we feel. And often when those are out of alignment, there's something going on we got to pay attention to. So I was feeling really big feelings around confusion and shame, but I couldn't name them. I couldn't name them because I wasn't in the context that allowed me to. And so my behaviors, though, were to push everything away from my culture and background and pull everything towards me that was around whiteness and middle classness. And so that's called internalized racism. And many minoritized people experience it. Not everybody, but many do. And so that's kind of how our wiring sort of shows up, and our desire to fit in and socialization, especially when you come from minoritized backgrounds.
And by the same token, white people tend to internalize dominance, even if it's not something they can name.
That's absolutely true. I'm so glad you raised that. So we are many ways, socialization plays such a deep part of not just like how we think and behave, but how we think about ourselves. And so people who are white, people who are male, people who come from dominant identities, basically are just in an environment where everything is normalized for them and for us, because I also identify as male, cisgender. And so what that means is that we come to see ourselves as normal. And when we are in the dominant group and we get to come to see ourselves as normal, it's very challenging when we get called out, because see, we're creatures of habit, and we most of the time move through the world on autopilot. And when we are on when we are from the normal, when we are normalized, whether we are white or male, for example, or straight, that we just tend to see the world and move through it in an unconscious way, on autopilot. And yet, and so when we get criticized, we react because it's like, wait a minute, I'm not bad. I didn't see that. I didn't experience. And so this is where it becomes really important to recognize that with internalized dominance comes fragility of not knowing. This is one of the drawbacks of being from the dominant group, is that we're going to get criticized at some point, whether we're male, whether we're straight, whether we're able-bodied, whether we're white. And it's because we can't see it. We can't see the ways in which we are benefiting from just moving through the world, whether it's our names in an evaluation process or resumes, as I talked about, to any other parts of our identity, how we're normalized and seen in media and sports teams and so on. But when we come from the non-dominant group, one of the benefits of being non-dominant is that you can see what other people can't, because you have to experience it. It's kind of like, you know, it's like privilege is like a wind at our back. We can be moving down the sidewalk or on our bike and not even realize that we're being buffeted and supported by this gentle wind behind us. But people who are walking to the headwind can feel the wind, right? Because it's affecting them. It's like our identities become like our own microclimates with headwind and tailwind pushing and pulling us in certain ways. And so with dominance comes drawbacks, which is we can't see and experience things that other people can't. And as a result, it makes us fragile because we don't know. And fragility is just that. It's just a state of not knowing.
By the way, I love the fact that you mention in the book and here that you have taken the implicit associations test multiple times over the years and looked at your different results because, I mean, given your immersion in this work, I would have to assume that you're sort of farther along in this process than a lot of us, but it shows that this is not, this needs to be an ongoing process, right? It's not like a one and done, like I've taken this training course or I've spent 6 months doing these things. It's a lifelong process.
To uncover, it's exactly that, Chris, is that to uncover and start understanding the system patterns that are at play and become system thinkers around issues of racism and oppression, we've got to learn to really step outside ourselves. We've got to, A, get comfortable with our identity, other people's identities, right? I think for many white people, in our trainings, it becomes a real insight when they start realizing they too have an ethnicity. And that there is something around whiteness that also is part of their background, and that really affects people. And being comfortable with identity, our own and other people's, is part of the lifelong process. Developing historical political knowledge is another part of that process. So, for example, if you don't understand the historical context, for example, of blackface, then you might not understand why. For the African American community, that to color one's skin, to darken one's skin for Halloween or for a play or something like that, is as offensive as a swastika might be to the Jewish community. If you don't understand the historical context, you're not going to get it. So it's a lifelong process of understanding historical context and identity. And the last thing that I would say is that it's about practice. It's sheer practice over and over and over again. So I am on a lifelong journey. The only thing is that I'm a little bit more comfortable making mistakes than other people might be. And so that just means it's like watching our kids throw a ball or try to swing, hit a ball with a bat. Like, they're awkward. We're all awkward. We're clumsy. But then they throw the ball 10,000 times or swing a bat 10,000 times, and they're much more comfortable because it becomes easy. So if anything is challenging for you right now, it's like any lessons through school, do it 100 times, and just the sheer repetition will make it more comfortable for you. And that's a part of both the psychological pattern recognition and the racial pattern recognition. It's just skills. It's just repetition. And so I really invite people to step into it, realizing that it's akin to any habit, that habits are hard to break. A New Year's Eve habit is hard to make, because you usually have to break an old habit en route. Well, basically, racial justice, gender justice, these are habits that are not just individual, they're institutional, they're cultural, they're structural, and they're passed down so easily. So we've got to be able to see them in order to disrupt them. And that's just a process of learning and being gentle with ourselves, because we're not going to be perfect. There's no such thing, which is why we need to do racial justice without shame and blame that inevitably comes with this kind of content and context.
Shaquille, you offer some counter-stereotype plans we can all use that help us to instantly connect with the individual humanity of somebody from a different group, rather than unthinkingly making the assumptions our brain might leap us to based on race or some other category. I was really interested to read about the carrot question, and I think this one's really going to stick with me. And will you talk about how this works?
Yeah, for sure. So the front end of that is that we have the ability to dehumanize, and researchers have, scanning during scans of our brains while we're thinking, while we're observing, while they're watching, and what they're basically finding is that we don't know how the mechanism works yet, but we are able to dehumanize. There's certain parts of our brain that literally just can turn off when we're dealing with racial outgroup members. So it's very quick. It happens again at the unconscious level, different than when we're dealing with outgroup members, when we're dealing with racial others, people we perceive to be different than ourselves when they're from minoritized groups. Now, that is quick, that is fast, that is easy. And if you don't believe that you do it, and often liberals especially will say things, "Oh, Sheila, I know who you're talking about, and it's not me." And then I'll say, well, okay, dehumanization is part of the human experience. It's part of what we do. So think about how you feel about people on the other side of the political spectrum. Do you treat them as threats? Do you think that they are a threat to our way of life? And then you start seeing how easy it is to dehumanize. And so that's the dehumanization front. So we can throw people out of the human box in a heartbeat. And it can, we have at that feeling level, not at the conscious level. We got lots of words for our conscious level, but the unconscious level, which is bigger and more influential, we dehumanize. You can see the polarization in society right now, right around politics, around race, and so on. But there's also solutions, and this is what I love about social science research, which is different than traditional historical sociological analyses, is that social scientists are experimenting. They're like, how do we fix this problem? And they're trying different things. And one of the things they found that's really easy is you can throw people back into the human box, people who are different than you, by asking a simple question. I wonder if they like carrots. I wonder what kind of home they grew up in. I wonder what sports they liked. And so I wonder if they like carrots is just a lead question to say, humanize people. And you humanize them by asking simple questions that takes them out of the group box, the blob box. We see people just as like a symbol of a group. And when we do that, we dehumanize them rather than an individual. And we ask the questions that individuate. How might carrots help, right? What do they like? What do they do? Asking those individual questions takes them out of that dehumanization box and starts humanizing them. It's that easy, but it requires practice. It requires consciousness. It requires us to be vigilant about our own sketchy behavior, which we all have. And so, my message for people is to be on the lookout for that. And then there are tools. Also, when challenging anti-Black racism, for example, researchers have found if you say with outgroup members, people you perceive to be different than yourself, whether it's the homeless, whether whoever it might be, Muslims, people you just seem to be very different than you, you can also do something simple by just saying safe.
Explain how that works.
Just simply say, this person's safe. This person is kind. This person is, and go counter stereotypes. So go towards things that you don't expect with this. So if you see a Muslim woman wearing a hijab, this woman's a scientist. This woman is a lecturer at a university, is an architect. Go to the counter stereotypes. Go to things that are different than what you expect. And even that can start helping you rewire. It's a practice, and I go into some of these in my book, but there are ways, they're simple. They work with motivating our emotions and our brain and thinking about how we are wired and how we rewire ourselves. And some of these things aren't that difficult, but it requires commitment and it requires compassion. Commitment, compassion are actually the things that we really need, are the fuel that will help us make the change we need. Shaming, blaming, not so much.
So I'm not holding myself out to be any kind of example here, but there is an unhoused person whose area I sometimes pass on my way to work. Right. And I happened to notice one day when I was stopped at a red light that if he's not there with his things, all of his blankets are really neatly folded. And the idea that, like, this person that I might have been tempted to think of as a homeless person is a person who's maybe tidier than the average person. And it really did sort of shift the way I thought, not only about him, but all the other people that I found it far too easy to pass without considering.
That's right. And especially in the context of homelessness, people who are unhoused, who we perceive to be street involved, what happens is the emotion that most dominantly comes up, according to the research, is contempt. It's like the vicious, most vicious form of dehumanization is contempt for the people. And so what you notice is really important. And so, you know, go have a conversation with people that you perceive to be different than you, and be engaged and start altering your own pathways. So homelessness brings up all these issues. But if you start asking the question of, like, this is somebody's brother, this is somebody who has a history, this is somebody who went to school and had friends, and we start humanizing the person, it actually opens up our hidden superpower, which is empathy, right? Now, empathy is not enough. We also got to move to action. But these are the baby steps we need to take towards moving and moving forward. And so this is where these are examples of the psychological literacy that I think is important, that we need to marry with the political literacy, the racial pattern recognition with the psychological pattern recognition, that we see these things. It helps us make the change we need to and to move forward and to do it in a way that is constructive and, you know, embraces all of our humanity.
Shaquille, sometimes people will point to bad choices made by members of disadvantaged groups as the primary source of their misfortunes. And you offer a really different perspective in the book on how we might think about this. Will you share that?
So one of the things that we know is that outgroup behavior, people that we perceive to be different than ourselves, we notice everything, and we especially notice the differences, and we especially notice the mistakes, right? So we had a situation here not too far from where I live outside of Toronto, where Asian anglers were fishing in the countryside, and suddenly this became this issue where they were being harassed by local white people. And when there was an investigation done by the Human Rights Commission, there were all these examples where a white angler might have seen one Asian angler keep an undersized fish. And suddenly that was translated to all Asians do this, and that they're raping our lakes. And there was no evidence to say that any group, white, East Asian, South Asian, Black, whoever's fishing, there was no evidence that any group was doing anything more or less than the other, but we are designed to notice outgroup behavior. And especially when it breaks a social norm. So this is why it's really important that if we know that, that's a pattern, that's a psychological pattern recognition. It's like, right, my tendency is to notice this, so I'm going to disrupt by going, right, examine when my feeling says, oh, is this exemplary of the whole group. And so we see this with, you know, Islamophobia. We see this with schools, with any kind of mass shootings. Anytime the victim comes from a non-dominant group, suddenly the generalization is made about the whole group itself. And when it comes, when if there's a mass shooting and the victim and the shooter tends to be white, we tend to think about mental health issues first. And that's where the in-group, out-group, and power dynamics start playing out.
We have an email here from Don who writes, a growing body of research finds that holding a fixed mindset, the belief that people cannot change, contributes to discrimination. For example, people holding a fixed mindset are more likely to endorse stereotypes focused on in or out group differences and are more likely to resist diversity training. And Don wants to know, Shaquille, how the fixed mindset concept aligns with your work.
Well, I mean, we have tendencies, right? We have temperaments that we show up with in the world when we're born. Some people are very adaptable and some people are a little bit more nervous. And so the fixed mindset, there's research out there that looks at some of us are born with more sensitive amygdalas and the mid part of our brain that is sort of like the alarm center and monitors our emotional state and puts us into fight, flight, or freeze. Some of us are born with just a way more sensitive amygdala. And so we tend to see the world in more black and white. We tend to see the world in yeses and nos. And others of us have more flexibility. And so we're more adaptable and we can deal with the grays of life. And you see this often with liberals and conservatives. You see this kind of thing. So it aligns. And what it means, it doesn't mean it's insurmountable, but it does mean that we have to be aware of who we're talking about and how we're working with these things. And that's not about biological determinism, just to be really clear, but that there are impulses that we grow up with. And then the environment we're socialized in can push us to one direction or the other. So I'd say that it is part of the equation. It's not the only part because socialization is a big part of it. But yeah, we come with temperaments. And so we have to work with those. And so that's what I would say to that comment.
I just have 30 seconds left for you, but you suggest we think about democracy less as a noun than a verb. Can you quickly tell us what you mean by that?
Yes. Justice work is a part of the democratic institution. And sometimes we think we've got the right to vote, so therefore we have democracy. And I think we've got to have a much more dynamic definition of democracy. Democracy for me is what's any step that we've taken? Does it increase more access, more voice for all communities, not just some communities? So it's a practice we should be able to work on and build on and increase.
Shaquille Chaudhry is an educator and consultant who does justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion work. His book is called Deep Diversity, A Compassionate Scientific Approach to Achieving Racial Justice. Shaquille, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Hey, Chris, it was a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at KERA Think. We hope that you will subscribe to the Think podcast. It's free wherever you get podcasts. You just have to search for KERA Think and subscribe. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.